Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Mehta Sama. Mehta Sama lives and works in Brooklyn, New York, and Plainfield, Vermont. An educator, poet, editor, scholar, and activist, Sama has published essays on Toni Morrison and Audre Lorde, and has published poetry and book reviews in Zone 3, Crab Orchard Review, Blackbird, The Drunken Boat, Her Circle Zine, among others. She is the fiction editor for Ragazine and is author of South of Here by New Issues Press. Welcome, Mehta.
Thank you. Hi, Jan. Thanks for inviting me here.
Yeah, it's really exciting to have you here. And you're going to start with some poems from South of Here.
Yes. Okay. I'm going to start with a poem called The Passion Flower Was the First State Flower. Every time I write about irises in the summertime, my mother breezes her way into my syntax, a verbal play, a premeditated semicolon, a parenthesis of white skirts, a nurse's uniform. The only color gleaming through her facade is her hair, pulled back, tight as silence, persistent as hints of coded language. No coloreds allowed. No coloreds allowed. No coloreds anywhere. Color erased from every visible surface or fine-tuned into the metaphor of the week. See my mother there? A quotation mark of respectability. No hair out of place, and half a dozen children with invisible whips marking their backs and ankles for days. Red whips puckering through the whitest socks, the whitest panties. The odor of bleach alone should have been enough to send the neighbors to the police. Something's afoot, they could have said. But they were white people stealing the sun from his sky. White people dying to be just a dozen shades darker. White people devastating the sun of his rays. And we, devastating the color from our clothes, the very sweat of whiteness persistently mouthing, niggers here. In a town where the purest white iris replaces the passion flower without a fight, in a town where the memory of black bodies dangling like neglected daisies from the Walnut Street Bridge is covered in blue paint and new wooden planks, in a town where wild grass hides the shut-down black schools, who could own up to such resentment? The shame of wanting to be one shade darker, one shade closer. Our hair struggling to be free of rubber bands reminded us of our place. The one strand never anticipating the braid of switches, the sting of a thousand swipes, an arm angrier and heavier than the tiny mother delivering the blows. The one woman reeking of bleach, swearing, "Baby, this is gonna hurt me more than it's gonna hurt you. I promise, okay?" Tiger Lily. It was 1939, not quite 1940. Alexander Hill's small kitchen welcomed my mother's birth. Wild duck clusters separated from the Tiffin galaxy before the sun completed its full revolution. Maybe the sun foresaw Mr. Hill's foot before my grandmother, but they felt the impact simultaneously. Listen to what I'm saying here. It's 33 hours before 1940. My mother enters the world on an eggshell white kitchen floor, her first kicking only complemented by the first whispers of nigger sloshing through blood, footprints, ammonia, and a 2.5 minute old baby. The earth pauses to take notice, accepts its responsibility to love my mother 2.5 minutes more than the rest of the world. 1960, some small town in Kentucky, Paducah or such. A scene so simple, the finer lunar eclipse of the decade makes an appearance. A small diner on the route to Chattanooga, Tennessee. The no-colored sign politely removed the year before. There's my mother, the only colored in the joint, hair smelling like sweat and wild sunshine. The waitress wears white and pink, her name tag overburdened with butterflies and cat whiskers. Holly, somewhere in the middle, seems friendly enough. Holly can't or won't serve my mother. We can call my mother Carrie now. Young Holly refuses Carrie on the other side of the counter. The fat man in plaid at the end sizes Carrie up. It's hotter than the innards of them there piglets you serve in, Han Holly? The man could be skinny with slicked back hair, but it doesn't matter anymore. He's white, and the no-colored Zillion salad removed the year before still lingers. Get the hell out of here, nigger. You hear me, gal? We don't want us no trouble. Carrie can't believe in their spirits, so orders a burger, fries, and a bottle of Coca-Cola to go, looks deep and direct into the fat man's eyes. Some kid calls her nigger and kicks her in the knees. Carrie steps slowly outside, tells the bus driver, put the bus in park and shut down the engine. I ain't leaving here without my food. Holiday Hill Circle and the magnolia blossoms are not in bloom. Their cupped white hands have fallen brown. It's autumn. Carrie and her husband have moved their 6 wild nigger babies into the all-white neighborhood, affecting property values. It is 1978. Residents begin packing their bags, remove all of their belongings. She wonders how many more times the cosmos will protect her, will ignore the rest of the world to wrap around her. Her children, naked, stand in the night, feel the pulse of stars in their hair, the breath of grass in their feet. Each child opens her mouth, holds out her tongue, waits for the moon to pause. Carrie, the day you were born was house cleaning day at the hills. The wind's hand momentarily paused. Leafless trees shifted. The sun unexpectedly appeared in Chattanooga to witness your entrance into this world, then bowed to baptize your forehead. I like to believe you received your first cellular kiss exactly 22 seconds before that kick shifted your tiger lily heart. Can I tell you, here under the maple trees of the Midwest, I finally began.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Metta Sama. She's reading from her new book, South of Here, published by New Issues Press. You know, those poems are so powerful, and, you know, I was thinking of, what goes into writing a poem like that, and it's kind of hard to name that, I'm sure, but I want to ask you about how do you get the courage to say things that are difficult to say in poems? Mm. What is some of your process, at least?
I think that a lot of these stories that I write about in South of Here, stories that my family have been telling to me for decades. And very often before I knew that I wanted to write poems, back when I thought I was going to be a playwright, and later when I'd given all of the writing up and thought I was going to be an attorney. So I've been living with these stories for a very long time, and living with my own experiences of the South, and living also, I think, with my own curiosities about whether and about landscape, and trying to see weather and the material world as somehow coexisting, so that the stories themselves, as painful as they are, don't become too painful to write about when I have the landscape, you know, the natural world to look at to help me make sense about, you know, what's going on in the regular world. And also just having distance from those stories at some point, you know, knowing that 30 years have passed since these treacheries have taken place, you know, helps a lot. And feeling that I'm not writing for myself, you know, that I'm writing to be in conversation with a larger public, makes writing anything a lot easier, but makes writing these kinds of stories a lot more necessary.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think we all know, you know, people who have lived with stories for many, many years and have not found those ways to write them. And for our listeners out there, I know there are many people out there who have not yet written those stories. You know, you've given a lot of examples of what has helped you in writing them. Any advice you might want to give to someone who has the stories but doesn't know what to do next?
Yeah, I would say to sit down and give yourself some prompts. You know, write the secret. That's always a really great prompt. Write the secret that you've been holding on, and just put it in a journal. Just get it written out and write it many, many times. Write that one story as many times as you can, maybe for a week, maybe for 2 weeks, until you feel bold enough to write it for a public, but to just do the writing, even if in the beginning is for yourself.
Yeah. Okay. Could you read some more poems?
Yes. So I'm still reading out of South of Here, and I'll read Chattanooga Times, July 24th, 1963. On his 16th birthday, he caught a bullet in his left shoulder, stealing Cokes from a corner grocery. The owner, another white guy, another diminishing white town. The town losing itself, resisting possibilities. Sunny day rains, scarlet begonias thrashing in dirt, and boys stealing hot Cokes. The Cokes fizz free, the Cokes for whites only. Coca-Cola calls my father by name, Sunny. Sunny with the sunshine smile, the smile even charms clouds. Sunny who can't remember what the white man looked like, where the bullet entered, but how it burned him awake. Invisible boy no longer. Shards of glass swim furiously, frantically, in soda and dust. I'm going to read a poem that is a guzzle. I think that's how you say it. I'm not really sure. It's G-H-A-Z-A-L. For those of you who are interested in this form, I'm very fascinated by this form because there's this refrain of the last word, and then you call yourself by name in this poem. It's like you're being asked to take responsibility for the poetics, but also for the various elements of the form. And it's written in couplets, and each couplet is supposed to be discrete. And this one is, I called it an African-American guzzle because it turns the refrain upside down. And then one thing that is important to know at this moment in my life, I was answering by the name Jade. So that will be the name for you to listen for. Sign, signifier, signify, signified. An American African guzzle. I've heard death is a white man in black tie, a man captive in a trick of black. I hear myth, an earthworm moving an inch at a time, urging black earth aside. Elms in winter displace heat, turn black as damaged snow. In theaters before curtains release and withdraw from black, music lingers, intactly absence, silence. Exercise patience. How does black myth survive? I hear a black man in red face, red stripes slashing through hair is death. Black mothers in kitchens seduce flour into loaves of bread, and men, black as coal, squeeze the necks of cotton stalks, anticipate struggle, create black gospel, black blues, black jazz, hear music's possibilities. Unrelenting black whips damage myth their beaten backs. In Europe, the black plague created black deaths 200 years prior to Shakespeare's Othello. The black Moor strangled his wife prior to the introduction of black comedy. Before the stock market collapsed in 87, brokers held Monday until it too could become black. Waiting around for another invention, Mel lost its innocence to black. Then black sex, black satire, black ice. Too clever for this setup? Soon, dawn will erupt, precise, breathtaking, the un of black. And here we linger in black images, repeating phrases as if they are truth, as if the structural design of words hold black like fear. The myths fall in on themselves, but how we hunt for the blackest diamonds, the blackest metaphor. Strangers live resilient under interstate overpasses, black as exhaust in valleys of ash buds, heavy as rain clouds, infinite as nebula. On the corner, a black man contains himself in wilting dust particles, jaded as tossed napkins, spare change, coffee, crows. So I'm going to change the tone a little bit and get into some poems that that are also out of South of Here that I was writing a lot about trying to find my own identity. And this is one of the ones called Inescapable as Aura. The water in the kitchen faucet finally stopped dripping. Nearly. Always and almost. The consistency of looking in the mirror as if for the first time. Imperceptible beauty, creases of skin on the edge of the right eye, almost enough to make you admit that 4 or 5 or 10 years ago, you were a wrecked kid, thin and particularly unattractive, especially to yourself, especially on Tuesday afternoons when you were forced to outrace your sister and her friends. Your sister's pace outruns you, but allows you to win the one time your father appears at a track meet. You faint at the finish line, thirsty and first, dry-throated and salting around the forehead, nearly looking like your father after a day of working in the yard, trimming oaks, picking magnolia fruit, picking himself out of the grass, out of the holes in the fence, almost long enough to make his wife happy, long enough to not talk that day, trimming and weeding and cutting and eventually looking over at his wife, stooping and frowning over a patch of wild dandelions, a patch of wild onions growing furiously, weary along the sidewalk.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Mehta Sama, reading from her book, South of Here, published by New Issues Press. I'd like to talk, if we could, about shifting language, shifting names, and yet in the midst of this seeming, I don't want to say search for identity, that's kind of cliche, but this urge to claim that I keep feeling, claiming space and then sort of like getting rid of it almost. It's like, okay, claim this, now I'll move on. And you said, I used to answer to the name Jade. And,
yes.
You know, maybe you could fill us in a little bit.
Oh, that is so very apt. For a good number of years, about every 3 years, I changed my name. I felt that I was shedding some cells, not the full body cellular shedding that you go through every 7 years, but, you know, that kind of surface shedding of cells. That was this every 3 year process. And it always felt really right to me. You know, I was in this headspace where I felt very seriously that people entered lives for a reason. And that when that time was up, it was up. And that seemed to happen in this 3 year cycle. And so I felt that, you know, I had these 3 years to figure something out about myself. And I would say that as cliche as searching for identity is, it's really quite accurate. It's really quite true. You know, I felt that there were so many identities that were living inside of me simultaneously, and I wasn't really sure who they all were. Mm-hmm. You know, and so changing the names and changing the identity and, you know, getting rid of all of the accoutrements that comes with a name, you know, getting rid of the hairstyle, getting rid of the
clothes.
Jewelry, getting rid of the clothes, you know, imagining different accents, you know, like really leaving town, you know, just moving to new places. Yeah. Those things were really important to me. I really felt that I was running a lot and running hard and fast.
Well, you changed your first and last names, right?
Yes.
Legally, did you do this?
No, I never changed them legally. All of the visual artists think that I kind of punked out because there are visual artists who do this as projects. They change their names once a year or once a 2 years.
Whatever. I mean, it's your business, whatever you're doing. But I'm really interested in how this shifting translates into your work and this claiming of space translates into your work, because I know it seems like the body is always essential in this, and mm-hmm. the relationship of the body to this shifting mm-hmm. seems to figure prominently in your work.
Mm-hmm. It does. Thank you for that question. It's a really great question. I feel that in this changing of identity, changing of self, that one of my obligations is to imagine new language, to imagine new ways of communicating with people. You know, that I'm supposed to learn something in that 3-year time period. And very often one of the things that I learn is how to relate to human beings. I'm not a communicator by nature. I'm an organizer by nature. And so in that change, there is my art that picks up different shapes, different styles, different forms, different structures. You know, if I'm dealing with the same kind of topics, if I'm dealing with questions of gender or questions of class or questions of race, you know, if I come back to that, if I revisit it, I feel like I'm obligated to revisit it in a wholly different structure. You know, something really has to significantly say to myself and to say to the readers, this is not necessarily the same mind that constructed that first book. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same person, but the mind has evolved. Mm-hmm. You know, the mind has learned something and is coming at this newly.
And also notice that when you talk about space or area, that you're rarely talking about a physical space.
Right.
You're talking about a psychic space.
Yeah, very much all the time. Mm-hmm. I'm talking psychic space. I'm talking spiritual space. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm very rarely thinking about the physical space mm-hmm. That my body inhabits. You know, I'm thinking very often in images. I'm a very visual person, mm-hmm. You know, and so I'm always trying to translate those visual images into some kind of language. But the space, I'm always thinking about space mm-hmm. All the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd like to hear some more poems. Are you reading some new poems?
I'm going to jump into some new poems. We've made this nifty transition, so I'm going to jump into some new poems. And these poems are from a chapbook that's called Vacant Moon that is almost done. And this poem is called Whatever Beauty. 1. A is in love. Still she breathes in the phone with a married man who is teaching her to nurture her nurturing side. He has bought her a pot-bellied pot, soil, rocks, and a large plant. Today he will teach her the sensual art of fertilizing roots. 2. Although he tells her she's stupid and lucky to have any man, B clings to her guy. She suspects he's cheating, tears through his closet, then carefully refolds his sweaters, pants, marries his socks. She asked me to send holiday cards to her parents' house. One less lie to sift through, she says, before asking, how's A? 3. See, for 2 months now, I've dreamed myself in Cairo with a man whose face presses into itself like an accordion when he laughs. We drink tea, talk to children, and pause 5 times during the day to pray, then make love. He never mentions his wife and 6 children in Durban. I never mention my lover in Binghamton. Every night I wake with my hand pressed into my mouth and hum a song that lulls my lover back to sleep. 4. After she discovered I could be honest on paper, my mother sent me a letter outlining my father's affair with a sister from church. She said she'd never give her body to another man. She said nothing of the heart. Queries and Speculations. If the city sleeps in tiny Chinese teacups, think of the amount of tea consumed, the fortune swallowed. What corner of the universe holds us? Are we free to investigate the uncertainties? See those ants insisting on that mound? Do they recognize the air's sense is senselessness? The cosmos could shift for a hint of that specific scent dogwood trees leave after a winter's rain. A tiger moth extends a precocious dream. The other day, a squirrel looked me precisely in the eye. Lights blinked on and off. Cobwebs around. I have a magic wand in my aloe. A friend in a place called Kalamazoo pinpoints the symmetry of dream. The ink in my pen keeps giving in to the possibility of snow. I'm craving deeply to love, to belong to a deja vu, to argue I'm exactly where. I mean, I'm here on this mood-swept couch, a rush of leaves, dead, underfoot. Soon I'll bury myself in Kandinsky or ride a blade of the ceiling fan. Soon I'll invite the airy moon in, smell the bluest flowers on my skirt. With all the frogs in this house, it's no wonder the tongue is so restless. The heart wants to really leap, disintegrate, scatter. I am not with me. The flies kick my synapses. But I do love the rain. Outside, crawling along the wall, vines imitate the lives of geckos. Scrape the side. And I'll say that, you know, almost embarrassingly, I have this addiction to putting one poem from my undergraduate career in a manuscript. And this is that poem for this manuscript. Scrape the side. I'm an oilcloth stuck in the back pocket of jeans you don't wear anymore. Brass buttons on a work shirt. Over-exaggeration. Under-simplification. You make me feel like a Jezzy, a Madge, Rita, or Barb, a hole in the arm of a nightshirt, a scrape down the side of a chalkboard, a shoe neglected in the driveway, remnants of broken glass, a telephone left off the hook, a funeral, a color, a design, a mute, a commercial snatched from the air, a sonnet confined by its own form, a villanelle, villainous. This ink in my pen could kill you.
We have time for one more.
Okay, I'll read one more poem from South of Here. And this poem's title is taken from a Walt Whitman poem. And it's for my best friend, Angela. From under that yellow half moon, late risen and swollen. And when I dream of Tennessee, I see a young man who believes in harmonicas and dusty feet. Women in scarves, blues dragging heavy through tongues of men. When I dream of Tennessee, Bibles fluster desperately, evangelical. They surround me, green and multitudinous. I can't ask for help. The Bibles have replaced faces of the young. Only once a red Bible haunts. When I dream, mountains walk into the ocean, fish rise from the sea, hands baptize my unrelenting forehead. When I dream, it is your death. You lie on a silver bed with no mattress, only blue-plated springs. Your eyes move with mine. The springs move with the effort of death. Silver wraps around and engulfs me, lines the thrust of my face. I cannot see. When I dream, you ride through tunnels with your butt out the window, flashing any passersby not willing to see. Wet roads built like snakes. Two girls take curves like death, fierce and quiet. I dream of stars thrown at dogs. We chase each other up trees, rise through dirt like wild onions. When you dream, girls jump railroad tracks in baseball fields, mercurial. You dream gospel choirs, ice storms, bare feet plunging through unforeseen snow. When we dream, you squeeze me through colanders or grate me so fine, I'm only cells within cells, veins liquid and lost, never quite fitting. The wind doesn't blow anymore when I dream. When I dream, the pastor presiding over your funeral no longer cites my name, no longer anticipates my return. When I dream, I drop into the ocean, fish myself from the sea, wind towards heaven, towards you, love, hopeless as kudzu strangled trees. Friend, when I dream, I know you are not death, only Tennessee mountains valleying quietly around.
It's the poetry of Metta Sama. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Wonderful. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.